This is the Cato Daily Podcast for Tuesday, September 27th, 2016. I'm Caleb Brown. The Declaration of Independence promises that when governments become destructive to liberty, it is within the rights of people to abolish those governments. So how has that worked out in history? Anthony Comegna, Assistant Editor for Intellectual History at Libertarianism.org, discusses one such event in Rhode Island. The short version, it didn't go well. The last time we spoke, I mentioned the phrase might makes right as sort of embodying this idea that the United States, growing rapidly in the 19th century, was becoming more powerful, and there were different groups of people who had different ideas about how that power ought to be used. But the people who thought America is unique, we have a better culture in a way, and that when we use our power, it is for good, and it's difficult, or was difficult, I suspect, for those people to imagine that things could go wrong, that that power could be used either mistakenly or maliciously.
Today, we're going to talk about one instance where things went very wrong, almost farcically wrong, for the libertarian forces, if you will, of the day. In Rhode Island in 1841, the state constitution was the oldest existing constitution in the world. And it's still one of the oldest, has you know, the record pretty high up there. But the state constitution in Rhode Island had not been changed in any way, not a single word changed, since 1663, when it was issued by King Charles II, right after his return to the throne. Well, not, right after he was welcomed back to the throne after Parliament had beheaded his father. Charles issues this charter, extremely liberal charter, to Rhode Island. George Bancroft, the 19th century historian, said, "Nowhere in the world have life, liberty, and property been safer than in Rhode Island." Well, by 1841, Bancroft was on the other side of the argument, and he actually argued, along with many others, that Rhode Island was not even a republic anymore. Now, how did that happen? Well, around the late 1600s, in some towns in Rhode Island, almost 90% of the white males could vote, which was extraordinarily high. It was the highest political participation rate anywhere on the planet, without a doubt. By 1776, about 75% of males could vote, white males. And only about 45% or so could vote by 1841. And this was because the Constitution, the old charter, had a landholding requirement for voting. Now, the forces of the Industrial Revolution, which took root in the United States first in Rhode Island in the 1790s with the Slater Mills, industrialization made it so that people didn't buy land. They congregated in cities, they worked in factories, and they didn't own land, especially if you were a poor immigrant. Of course, immigration from places like Ireland and Germany shot way up during the 19th century. So Rhode Island was filled and steadily filling with more and more landless white men. And because so many of them couldn't vote by the late 1830s, people like New York's Locofoco newspaper editor Levi Slam started arguing that this is no longer a republic, and that the Constitution requires, it guarantees citizens republican forms of government. So Rhode Island would have to change its constitution, according to this argument. Now, somebody that this was very persuasive line of reasoning with was Thomas W. Dorr. He was a Rhode Island lawyer, representative in the state legislature. He was a worldly man, a revolutionary. He was interested in all the uprisings in Europe in the late 1820s and 30s. He wanted the same thing to happen in the United States, especially in Rhode Island, which he and his supporters looked at as retaining a feudal constitution from a bygone era before the Revolution. And in 1841, the summer of 1841, Dorr and his supporters convene a People's Constitutional Convention, right? So the People's Convention gets together and they write a People's Constitution, which they submit to voters in October, and they won huge numbers of support. They won the vote 13,944 to 52. So to their mind, that meant that that was the new constitution of Rhode Island. They had summoned a, you know, a popular bottom-up convention that voted on it. They even got a majority of the freemen, so the landholders in the state, about almost 5,000 out of about 8,000 voted in favor of the People's Constitution. They had a majority. To their mind, that made it the new government.
And in a sense, like, that's the promise of the Declaration of Independence.
Absolutely. It certainly is. And, you know, of course, they they noted that over and over again, right? This is the American tradition of popular sovereignty, the right to revolution, the right to change your governments at will. Now, the existing state government did not give way, right? So what was called the landholders' government tried to outdo the Dorrites. They put up their own proposed constitution, which did not do away with the landholding requirement. It did not redistrict the state in any serious way. So representation issues were still extant. The landholders' constitution lost its plebiscite vote, 8,700 or so to about 8,000. So it was a narrow margin, but it lost. So by the time May comes around, April and May 1842, the Dorrites say, well, look, we just elected our governor, Thomas W. Dorr. He got elected governor, 6,000 votes. We have a whole new government in place where, you know, you guys get out of Providence and let us take over. Well, of course, the charter government did not give way. So you have a standoff in the state where there are these two rival state governments leading two rival state armies, basically, camped next to one another at Providence. And Dorr decides he's not going to wait for this to be solved politically. He's going to gather up his forces and try to make an assault on the Providence state arsenal. So that fails. It's a, you know, abject failure because nobody's ready. Nobody has any real military training, and it's not a serious effort to militarily take over the state. So Dorr's forces evaporate at basically the first sign of state militia. It's an interesting story. Dorr's father is actually inside the arsenal when Dorr goes up to take it. And his father says, well, you're going to have to blow us out of here if you want to take the arsenal. So they don't. And Dorr has to flee the state. And he goes to New York, where he stays a while with loco foco libertarian radicals there in the city. The New Yorkers pledge him military support. They say they're going to raise thousands of troops and give Dorr all the money he needs to wage civil war in New England. And they're all for it. They're gung-ho, excited. If you read the correspondence of these people back and forth with Dorr, they want a civil war. They want it to be a class war, too, which is something that libertarians often forget about, the notion of class as a social binding force. That in this case, they came together on ideological grounds. That's what separated the classes and the political power that was clearly being distinguished in the events in Rhode Island.
Now, you mentioned in the things that you've written and put up at libertarianism.org about this, Francis Whipple.
Yeah.
And there seems to be at this time, you mentioned class war and libertarians forget about that, but there seems to have been, if you look at the things that libertarians and modern progressives point to in the past and say, this was a good thing. There's plenty in this group of people that modern libertarians and progressives would both point to and say, I'm for that. Mm-hmm. That was a positive thing for history, like the end of slavery, for example.
Yeah, and by the way, the Dorrites, one of the problems was that they were anti-slavery, at least many of them were. Now, they put in their constitution, in the People's Constitution, they did insert a whites-only clause. But this is because they didn't think it would pass a vote if they didn't have it in there. So Dorr himself was actually a speaker for the American Anti-Slavery Society, and he was a full abolitionist, as were so many of his supporters. But they thought they needed to court the popular will. They had to court the popular vote. And the people, you know, this nameless, faceless, the people, surely wouldn't want to allow black people to vote. So we have to put the whites only clause in there. And they did away with, you know, slavery as a public discussion because they were trying. John Tyler in May, President Tyler committed to send troops into Rhode Island if necessary to prevent a civil war. So they had the administration arrayed against them, and they found out that it was because the Tyler administration, under pressure from Southerners, said, well, we can't admit the principle of universalism because if we do, what's going to stop it from applying to slaves? You know, Mississippi is 55% black. Same thing in South Carolina. What, are these not republics anymore because most of the population can't vote? Well, obviously, they're not republican forms of government. So we just can't admit the universal principle. And so they, you know, there was no national political coalition in the offing. But there was a determined effort on the part of people like Francis Whipple to make this happen, to make Rhode Island revolutionize. But it was a failure, and Whipple was very disenchanted by the level of failure. She wrote to Levi Slam saying the men in Rhode Island, the sheroes, she called them, the sheroes flee into the woods as soon as they see a musket flash.
That is some pretty bold terminology there.
Not exactly PC either. But, you know, she said that basically if people really want a revolution, they need to have the stomach for it. And the Rhode Islanders didn't. And so what happened is every time they came into an actual conflict, like at Chepachet later in the summer in June, they tried to take another state arsenal and completely failed. And the reason is because if you look through the eyewitness accounts or the letters written by people who were with Dorr in the army, these are young men. These are boys who basically wanted to impress girls in the neighborhood with their bravery and bravado. These are, you know, dads who wanted to show their sons that they're not wimps and they'll go out and fight. But they ran away. The assault at Chepachet failed. The New Hampshire Sentinel, a newspaper, said the controversy is now evidently not between the people of Rhode Island, but between the state and Levi Slam and other desperate, radical, destructive loco-focos out of the state. So they looked at this basically, the conservative forces that be in Rhode Island, the bulk of the population, steadily looked at this as something that the people were not necessarily behind, but that a bunch of outside radicals and ideologues were trying to foment revolution in Rhode Island, to make a political point about the charter and about sovereignty and all these other issues. They were trying to make it more than it actually had to be. And they were probably right about that because there certainly wasn't much planning and coordination. There wasn't this popular groundswell for civil war. There was no class consciousness, if you will, of libertarianism at the time like there was in 1776 or 75 or 4 for that matter. And, you know, ultimately though, the Dorr War was testing a specific doctrine. Dorr wrote to Governor Cleveland of Connecticut. He said, the doctrine of the cabinet at Washington is that our governments are corporations, that the authorities are the ultimate source of political power in this country, and that no changes of government can take place without the consent of these authorities. So the argument was, look, if we have to go through existing political institutions in order to change them, the institutions are sovereign, not the people. But of course, it's the other way around. The people are sovereign, not the institutions. And after the military efforts failed, the various ladies' societies in Rhode Island, the Female Suffrage Association of this town or whatever, Providence Ladies Suffrage Association, that sort of thing, all these different groups, they shifted from military efforts to ideological efforts to make their point. And they started hosting these great political fairs that were called the Clam Bakes because they, you know, all these people were exiled basically from the state of Rhode Island. Anybody who held office under the People's Constitution was exiled from the state under penalty if they were to return. And so what they did is they gathered together just across the border, across the water from Boston, you know, on the across the water from Providence on the Massachusetts side. And they held these huge fairs of clam bakes where they dug holes in the ground and they baked a bunch of clams and things in the and lobsters and stuff, made chowder. And speeches. They had political speeches. They had music, bands. You know, it was a fun time. And the speeches that were given were laced with manifest destiny, this growing idea, which John L. O'Sullivan had just recently coined the term. And it's growing as a concept in young American circles and in these radical Locofoco Dorite circles. The idea was that Rhode Island had a special place within this special nation, that Rhode Island would do the final work of casting out feudalism from North America by getting rid of King Charles II's charter and updating it with the people's own sovereignty, and keeping that principle, the right to revolution, first and foremost in American political thinking. Now, the clam bakes drew tens of thousands of people from all across New England, and they kept going for years. But after 1842, the landholders, the state government in Rhode Island that refused to give way to the People's Constitution, they did get their own constitution put together. They did address the problems, and they put it to a popular vote, and they got a new constitution. So they conservatively, peacefully addressed the concerns of the people in time. It did not take civil war in New England to do this, to fix the actual grievances that people actually had. So the clam bakes kind of died off after that point, many people thinking that, well, the cause failed and we lost to the landholders. And now this argument over suffrage is kind of buried. And the clam bakes did continue intermittently for a few years, but they were clearly political tools at this point, basically taken over by state Democratic parties to put up candidates for office on the stage and to, you know, draw thousands of people to hear their speeches. And that was it. And it worked because all these people helped elect James K. Polk in 1844. And we got the Mexican War, and we got slavery extended, and we got all these hopes and dreams of these youthful young Americans and Dorites dashed to pieces throughout the rest of the decade.
So the lesson here is do not put your hope in political institutions. Is that right?
Yeah, I think so. Or at least if don't put that much hope in it. Don't put your existential meaning, your purpose in life behind political reform. Now, the case did go to the Supreme Court, and in 1849, the court ruled in Luther v. Borden against Dorr. And they said, because he was in prison for several years after the controversy. The court said that the right to revolution might be natural and physical, but it's not constitutional and legal. So in essence, the court ruled that the political class, as it was currently constituted, is sovereign in America, not the people. The people do not have a constitutional legal right to revolution. And one historian, George Denison, put it this way. He said, "No one much bothered after the Dorr War with a constitutionalism based on the legal right of the people to alter their governments at will." This is simply an idea that disappeared from public discourse and from any sort of practice. He says, "Something vital had gone out of American ideology. Somewhere in the years between 1815 and 1862, a great American body lies buried. Unappreciated and unmourned, the old republic died giving birth to the Republican Empire. Might settled all questions about social ideals. Americans finally agreed that governments based on force were as necessary in the United States as they had always been elsewhere." And he continues that Americans became mere men and rejoined the world once again. So no longer an exceptional city on the hill, just another thuggish state. And you know, Frances Green, or Frances Whipple, her book was called Might and Right. That was really the question in their mind between power, the power of those currently constituted authorities, and the right of the sovereignty of the people.
Anthony Comegna is Assistant Editor for Intellectual History at Libertarianism.org. Subscribe to this podcast at iTunes, Google Play, and with Cato's iOS app. And follow us on Twitter at Cato Podcast.